This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Sexual assaults have long been a part of college life. For years, many colleges and universities assigned cases of sexual misconduct to student-run honor systems, which both students and administrators have criticized for being unfair and ineffective in administering due process to the accused and protecting the rights of the accuser. A UNC Chapel Hill student recently made worldwide headlines when she filed a federal complaint against the school for how it handled her sexual assault case. Last week, President Obama signed an updated version of the Violence Against Women Act into law, which includes reforms on how college sexual assaults are handled. What kind of impact it may have on future cases remains to be seen, but this hour we examine the complicated intersection of school jurisdiction, crime, and justice. We're joined by Kristen Lombardi, staff writer and investigative reporter for the Center for Public Integrity, who was part of the reporting team for their joint investigation with NPR, which aired in 2010, Sexual Assault on Campus, A Frustrating Search for Justice. She joins us for the first part of the program by phone. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you very much, Mike.
You're welcome. In our studios, Dr. David Spano, Associate Vice Chancellor for Health Programs and Services and Director of the Counseling Center at UNC Charlotte. Good morning and welcome to you.
Good morning.
And also with us, Jennifer Cook, Health Education Specialist at the Center for Wellness Promotion at UNC Charlotte. She coordinates prevention and support services for relationship violence, sexual assault, and stalking, and works with student victims. Thanks for joining us as well.
Morning.
Good morning. Just how big a problem has sexual assault been on college campuses historically? I'm not sure who to ask this question of. I'll begin with Kristen, and we'll take it down to the local level. Kristen, how big is this problem?
Well, I would say that it's a fairly the prevalence of sexual assaults on college campuses is a fairly widespread problem. I think it's a pretty pervasive campus crime, one of the most pervasive campus crimes. The study that everybody cites and has cited, I think, for the last two decades is a national study that found 1 in 5 college women will become the victim of a rape or an attempted rape by the time she graduates. And those statistics don't really seem to fluctuate very much. We tried to find more recent statistics. These are statistics from National Institute of Justice study, and everybody that we spoke to for our series, which, you know, first aired at the end of 2009 into 2010, so it is, you know, several years back. Mm-hmm. But at the time and since, everybody still says those statistics are relevant. So if you think about that, that's really a pretty chilling number. I don't think we would, as a nation, accept or tolerate that level. That's nearly 20% of all college women. I don't think we would tolerate that with any other kind of crime, violent crime.
Hmm. Let's take it down to the local level. How big a problem has it been traditionally at UNC Charlotte that you know about and or throughout the UNC system?
Well, I think the key question or the key part of your question is, what do we know about? And I think what we do know is that it's a traditionally very underreported crime. And mm-hmm. so what we know about, what shows up in our crime statistics, the number of students who present to our counseling center or to our dean of students or to our police is much lower than 1 in 5. So, you know, when we hear that statistic, we recognize that we need to do a better job of educating students about how to report and how to come forward when they experience
crime. But do the number of incidents that are being reported year to year vary greatly, or are they pretty much the same level every year, year in, year out, for years and years and years?
Those that get reported via our crime statistics are very low consistently year after year. Now, in the last couple of years, or actually in the last year, since the Dear Colleague letter, this is a letter that came from the Department of Education and the Office of Civil Rights has required us to really look at how we report those data. And I think what we're going to see is a real uptick in the number of reported assaults. And that's not because there are more, but because we're doing a better job of gathering that data and reporting it.
I want to come back to that. When students come, I guess students come to you, do they not, to deal with this problem?
They can either come to me. I mean, there's several avenues ways that they can seek services. So they can either come to me, they can present at the counseling center, they can present police and public safety. So we all try to coordinate in order to provide the best services for students. But they do come to me and to seek services as well.
I guess we should define what we're talking about here. What is sexual assault? How do you define it? Is it always a full-blown rape, or is it some variant thereof?
Well, sexual assault and rape, each state will define sexual assault and rape differently.
How do you define it?
How do I define it?
How does the university define it?
Well, we usually use we have our code of conduct, code of student conduct, which we have our sexual misconduct code underneath of that. And it can anything from sexual harassment all the way through sexual touching and rape. So we talk about any type of sexual touching all the way through penetration. Mm-hmm. So, and like I mentioned, each state defines that differently in terms of the definition of rape. Because that when we're talking about rape, there is usually some form of penetration.
So, Kristen, when you did your story with NPR and the Center for Public Integrity back in 2010, and you did this around the country, talk to me about how it was defined around the country.
What we did was, when we were looking at very specific schools, I guess I'm going to step back and just tell you sort of the background that we did.
Mm-hmm.
For this series, we interviewed 50 college officials that were familiar with the campus process and 33 female students who reported to schools being sexually assaulted by fellow students. And then we did a survey, a very, sort of social scientific-based survey of crisis programs and clinics connected to colleges throughout the country. It was a random yet representative sample, and we ended up surveying well over 50% of schools, crisis service programs or rape crisis clinics, and it was 152 in total. And then we also FOIA'd 10 years' worth of Title IX complaints that were filed against schools with the Education Department Office for Civil Rights, which is the office that's responsible for overseeing how Title IX is implemented. Title IX is really the federal law that is operative in these cases, and the guidelines that were released in April 2011 that David Spano referenced are very much based on what Title IX requires schools to do in terms of responding to these cases. And the point was to get beyond isolated cases on individual campuses, to connect dots, to see sort of larger commonalities and trends that suggest systemic problems when it comes to schools responding. We did find that schools on an individual basis may have variations to their definition of sexual assault. A lot of schools like to use the term sexual misconduct.
Mm-hmm.
We found in talking to college administrators that they really like to take the terms that the criminal justice system uses, like sexual assault and rape, those criminal definitions. They like to not use those because they don't want to create the impression that they are mirroring the criminal justice system. This is a separate system. This is a college disciplinary process. So a lot of schools use the definition, use the term sexual misconduct, and they defined it pretty much like Jennifer said, anywhere from, unwanted sexual touching, which, a person may not consider to be so egregious, all the way up to penetration. And what we did was really try to look at how schools define for themselves sexual misconduct, and when students file their reports, claiming sexual misconduct, what happened? It doesn't matter what it was. Now, we were, of course, much more interested in, I guess, what you would call the more egregious forms of sexual assault. Most everybody that we spoke with, the female students who we interviewed, were all students who reported being actually raped.
Hmm. I want to get back to something you said about how colleges want to distance themselves from the terms used by the criminal justice system because they don't want them to be viewed that way. But why not? And doesn't that whole form of operation lead to them turning these things over, these reported crimes over to honor systems or student courts? Why would these be turned over to student courts when these are, in many cases, absolutely criminal offenses?
Well, they're turned over to the criminal justice system on occasion as well. I mean, that just one doesn't preclude the other. And so when something happens on campus, we do have our internal judicial system. But we operate under a code of student conduct. We find students responsible or not responsible for violations of the code of student conduct based on a preponderance of evidence, which is different than the criminal justice standard. And so, they are separate processes, but one does not preclude the use of the other.
We're talking about criminal sexual misconduct or criminal sexual assault on college campuses on WFAE Charlotte Talks today. But why wouldn't you just automatically turn these over to the police? Why a student honor court or why the code of student conduct? To me, that would be in the jurisdiction you'd have over cheating on a test or not telling the truth or spreading malicious gossip about a teacher, not criminal sexual assault.
Well, and like Dr. Spano had mentioned, it is an administrative process. It's not a criminal process.
Why?
You know, we do.
It's a crime.
It is a crime, and we do encourage those victims and survivors to report that to the police so that it can go through the criminal process. And that's what we can do is encourage them to report that to the police so that they can get the justice through the criminal justice system. But unfortunately, we're different entities.
Did you
can I just jump
yeah,
in
Chris,
for a second?
Go ahead.
The question of why colleges are handling rape cases at all was pretty much the first question I wanted answered when we sort of set out to do this series. I think the answer we came to realize is twofold. We found very quickly that the criminal justice system often doesn't take acquaintance rape cases, which is very much the typical campus sexual assault case. I mean, these are students often that know each other. If not well, they at least know of each other. They're very, very difficult cases. Most of them involve allegations of cases involving allegations of campus sexual assault, I think, come down to he said, she said accounts. There's very rarely physical evidence, rarely eyewitness testimony. Alcohol and drug use can play a central role and complicate things. Like I said, the alleged victim and the alleged perpetrator typically know each other, and when we talked to college administrators and local district attorneys, we were told that the criminal justice system really just doesn't do a very good job of taking these cases.
Is that the same, or do you know the answer to this question? Is that the same in a non-campus situation with perhaps more mature adults than college students? If the same situation happened among acquaintances, would the criminal justice system be reluctant to pursue it?
I mean, I can't tell you quantitatively. Yes, it's the same. My sense is that the criminal justice system generally does not do well with acquaintance rape cases.
We have to take a break. We'll come back with more of this conversation in the next hour here with Dr. David Spano, Jennifer Cook, and Kristen Lombardi. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking about sexual assault on college campuses with Dr. David Spano, Associate Vice Chancellor of Health Programs and Services at UNC Charlotte, also Jennifer Cook, who is a health education specialist with the Center for Wellness Promotion there, and Kristen Lombardi, who is an investigative reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, who reported in 2010 in cooperation with NPR a series called Sexual Assault on Campus, a frustrating search for justice. You were in the middle of making a point about how the criminal justice system approaches all of this on and off campus. Kristen, you wanted to follow up on that.
Yeah, I wanted to make the point that many of the students we interviewed for this series and whose cases we documented went to local authorities. They went to the police. They tried to pursue criminal charges, and the district attorneys declined to prosecute. Hmm. And it spoke to, like I said, the very real difficulties in prosecuting these cases, acquaintance rape cases, to a degree that the criminal justice system requires, which is beyond a reasonable doubt. So the students that we interviewed, they went through the campus disciplinary process as a last resort. And I think that's really important to recognize. But it's also important to note that the other big reason why schools handle these cases is because they're required to do so by federal law. And that law is Title IX. And when a student comes forward and alleges sexual assault, a school under Title IX has an obligation, a legal obligation, to investigate that claim and take action to eliminate any harm. And that is the, you know, ultimate reason why schools are responding to these cases. Now, Title IX does not say that schools have to respond to these cases by using their college disciplinary process, but that's how traditionally most schools have responded to these cases. It's a question of students violating their code of conduct, and when students violate a code of conduct, they go through the misconduct process on campus.
But your investigation from 2010, and things may have changed since then, but they found that students found responsible for sexual assaults on campus often face little or no punishment from school judicial systems, while their victims' lives are frequently turned upside down. Do you know if that's still the case? Would that be the case at UNC Charlotte? Let me begin with Kristen again, and we'll come to we'll bring it local in a second.
Well, I don't think enough time has passed since our series to change that reality. As David Spano referred to in the last segment, the Education Department's Office for Civil Rights did issue new federal guidance for how schools should handle these cases and respond to these cases. And a lot of schools since April 2011 have been changing their policies and their procedures. I think in talking with a lot of people that we spoke with for this series, since as recently as a few months ago, punishment is still very, very much a problem. I say a problem. I'm sure, you know, victims who've gone through the process see it as a problem. But that reality of students being deemed responsible for sexual assaults and facing little punishment is still a reality.
Well, and Kristen makes, excuse me, in the previous segment and the beginning of this segment made a good point, as in the criminal justice process is beyond a reasonable doubt. And sometimes it is a little bit more difficult for victims and survivors to go through the criminal justice process. And so they do rely on the process, the conduct process through schools, and because it's a preponderance of evidence. And they can seek some relief in terms of removing that person from campus, that person being expelled, that sort of thing. And when I came on board, which was right after the Dear Colleague letter came out.
In 2011,
I was actually a new position for the university, a brand new position that was created. And that really helped. The sexual misconduct policy that we had was just in the process of being updated and changed, and it is a process of updating and changing some of these things. So, and it's great to have these guidelines from the Dear Colleague letter, because it helps us in terms of the policies.
Let's back up, because people don't
sanctions.
Know what that is.
Okay.
The Dear Colleague letter came out in 2011 from the Office of Civil Rights, directing colleges and universities to ensure that sexual assaults were reported and investigated appropriately. The language may go on and be more detailed from that point on, but that's the only language that I had at my disposal. So what does appropriately mean?
Well, first of all, in a timely fashion, we have 90 days to complete an investigation after it's
I believe we typically do 60 days.
60 days. Mm-hmm. And so doing it in a timely fashion, there have been stories of incredibly long delays in investigation, mm-hmm. which has been a problem for victims and survivors.
As I understand it, it can go on for a semester or two in some cases in the past in some college campuses around the country. And that, I think, is what you meant, Kristen, when you talked about victims' lives is being frequently turned upside down. They seem to be, in many cases in the past, have been under great pressure by fellow students, A, not to report these incidences, or B, being, I'm not sure what the word is, but being an outcast when they do.
Retaliation.
Retaliation, yeah. Mm-hmm. Is that still the case? That obviously is not still the case, at least not to your knowledge.
Well, and that was part of the guidelines in the Title IX, the Dear Colleague letter, mm-hmm. was this is – they put forth guidelines so to reduce that retaliation and protect those who have come forward and reported a sexual assault.
Daniel Carter, former director of public policy for security on campus, wrote in the Huffington Post that the greatest threat doesn't lie along a poorly lit walkway. It hides in plain sight in classrooms, residence halls, and student parties. Is that in light of what we were just talking about, the fact that there is sometimes retaliation and ostracization and people being encouraged to stay silent about this, that this happens in public view and nobody talks about it?
Right. I think that that's in reference to that. It's also in reference to the fact that most sexual assaults occur between two people who know each other, mm-hmm. who know of each other. And certainly, those people are in plain view.
So your report, Kristen, was prior to this Dear Colleague letter that came out in 2011. And when you reported on the story, how did the colleges that you investigated handle complaints of sexual misconduct? What was their process?
Well, that's very hard to generalize because each college is individual. It's very hard to generalize. I would say that one of the frustrations that we heard repeatedly from college administrators was that the Education Department's Office for Civil Rights was not clear at that point on what exactly is required by Title IX. And the Dear Colleague letter, if you read it, and if you read our series and you read that letter, you will see that that letter very much addresses a lot of the problems that we identified in the series with the process itself and with primarily with the process itself. How schools are supposed to go about responding to these cases. I mean, for victims who went through the campus judicial proceeding, they found that these proceedings were often shrouded in secrecy. They encountered mysterious disciplinary processes, closed-mouth school administrations, off-the-record negotiations. There were a lot of mediations, which the Education Department had deemed at that point to be illegal. There were some schools were implementing gag orders, meaning that, you know, if you filed a report, you weren't allowed to talk with anybody about the fact that you filed a report, which the Education Department, even at that point, had found to be illegal. So there seemed to be a lot of processes or practices being implemented across the country that were, for all intents and purposes, institutional obstacles that just compounded the problem that made victims feel re-victimized.
Was the process
at the end for those who did find quote unquote justice in the sense that their report ended with a student accused being found responsible? They really did. See very little in terms of actual consequence. I mean, for that, we reviewed a database of schools maintained by the Justice Department's Office for Violence Against Women, and that office gives out campus grants to colleges to help them better handle sexual assault cases, and it keeps track of those schools that receive federal funding. And it tracks all the cases that these schools handle. And so we were able to review that database that the office had compiled. And that's how we found that responsible findings very rarely lead to, you know, what the average person, I think, would consider tough punishment, like expulsion.
Right. What was the process at UNC Charlotte prior to the Dear Colleague letter in 2011, and was it standardized across the system? If a case was reported, was there a judicial process? Were there witnesses? Did either party have access to legal counsel? Did they need access to legal counsel? What was the process then? How has it changed?
I was not here before the 2011. Mm-hmm. I know that the Dear Colleague letter, the guidelines helped in making it a little bit more uniform and giving real guidance to universities. Prior to 2011, I'm not sure the process.
It was certainly not uniform across the system, and it was not in line with consistently with what the Dear Colleague letter prescribed. Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, Kristen Series, which was terrific, did a tremendous service for universities, not to mention, of course, for potential or you know, current victims and survivors of sexual assault. But nonetheless, we have now, since the Title IX or since the Dear Colleague letter, made our processes much more transparent. Anybody can go to the Police and Public Safety website, look at our crime report. In that crime report, a very transparent set of guidelines and the process by which these allegations are investigated and dealt with is there. So anybody can go there and read it.
Who investigates?
Our Dean of Students Office is primarily responsible for adjudicating those cases in the conduct officers
and
in that office.
Is it up to the student as to whether or not they want to go through this process as opposed to a criminal process outside of the college?
The student who makes the report maintains control over how that.
Why would a student want to use your system over a criminal system?
Well, because of some of the things that were mentioned, the criminal system is much harder to get a conviction in. Okay. There's a lot of obviously some reports that don't get investigated or don't get adjudicated. And if I can just make one more point, Title IX also requires that universities create an environment that's not hostile to students. And so if someone's on campus with someone who has been an alleged perpetrator of a crime, that's a hostile environment for that student. And,
right.
And universities must be aware that removing that student and making that a safe environment for a student is important.
So when you investigate these, what's the process from there on in? Kristen mentioned mediation. I mean, does it go to mediation? Does it go to some sort of a student court, a faculty court? Does it do both sides get to tell their story? Who passes judgment? When it's a he said, she said, how do you do it?
We do not do the mediation process. What I usually inform students of when they come to me, I try to give them what to expect when they go to report to the Dean of Students Office. And the Dean of Students Office, they try to allow the student to control the process in terms of, you know, empowering that student to make decisions about what they want to do. At some point, though, if there is a threat to campus safety, there are certain things that the Dean of Students has to go through with in terms of investigating. But they try to leave that process as much as possible up to the student. And so there's two ways usually that they resolve the case, and that's formally or informally. And informally is when the person who is accused takes responsibility and then they are sanctioned or, you know, there's some sort of punishment, but we call it sanctions. Mm-hmm. And then there's the formal process in which there is a hearing.
We're talking about sexual assault on college campuses today on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. What are the punishments now when somebody's found guilty or admits guilt, or how does it vary from the type of incident it turns out to be?
Well, I can't speak to necessarily, you know, what each case is going to be different in terms of the severity of punishment. I mean, it's anywhere, you know, from suspension all the way to expulsion. It really depends on the type of case it is. And I can't really speak to what the dean of students would do as a sanction or what their level of sanctions are.
But the options include expulsion, yeah, suspension, or lesser sanctions.
And you mentioned, Kristen, earlier that in, at least prior to this dear colleague letter, that rarely did punishments result in expulsion or things that were. Even for repeat offenders, things that were fairly definitive as punishments. Why? Didn't colleges and universities see this as a liability issue?
I think it speaks to the college disciplinary process and how college administrators view that process. And I don't want to paint college administrators as derelict or negligent in their adjudication of cases because I interviewed, you know, like I said, 50 of them altogether, and I thought many of them are thoughtful and genuinely seem to care about how to properly adjudicate these cases. What the disconnect is what the average person thinks, you know, an act like rape, you know, what kind of punishment that deserves and what happens in the college disciplinary process. And I think one reason why expulsion is so rare is because it really is anathema to the educational philosophy among student affairs administrators. I mean, student misconduct cases are seen sexual assault cases are seen in the broader context of student misconduct. You know, that includes acts like plagiarism, cheating, vandalism, physical assault, dorm drinking. And in conduct cases, the idea is to educate students found responsible for the misconduct. And that's why when we crunched the data in this Justice Department database, we found a lot of educational penalties. Like, for instance, writing a research paper was often one of the sanctions. One former university counsel who consults with schools on their sexual assault policies said to me, you know, if you want to know why schools are so reluctant to expel, it's because for an educator, expulsion is often seen as a failure on their part to do their job. And I thought that was fascinating. It didn't even occur to somebody like myself that that's how they see their role, educating students. Mm.
We have to take a break. I have to let Kristen Lombardi go. She's a staff writer and investigative reporter for the Center for Public Integrity, who wrote helped report on the sexual assault on campus series for NPR in 2010. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Dave Spano's with us, Associate Vice Chancellor of Health Programs and Services at UNC Charlotte, and Jennifer Cook, Health Education Specialist with the Center for Wellness Promotion there. Kristen Lombardi was with us earlier in the program from the Center for Public Integrity, but had to leave for another appointment. I'm going to take a couple of phone calls here, and we'll begin with Todd in Charlotte. Welcome to the program, Todd.
How you doing, sir?
Good.
My question would be, is everything I've heard is about the accusor, and I happen to be in a situation at the university where I'm the accused, and I'm faced with a situation where, because the university is not held to legal standards, hearsay is viable in these hearings, and I'm facing a situation where I was found responsible my first time through based off of a story of a girl that I had evidence against, and I'm facing the exact opposite of where the system's working against me because you're not held to these standards.
And you're talking about the University of North Carolina?
North Carolina, Charlotte, yes, sir.
Okay. You want to comment on that?
Well, you mentioned that you're not being held to the same standards because of – can you mention that again about hearsay? Is that what you said?
Yes, ma'am. Whenever I went to my initial hearing, the girl who accused me only had hearsay. The only thing she had was her story. And then I had, you know, my story, I had text messages, I had phone records, I had all these other things that were, you know, I would, like, walk into this thing like, okay, you know, this isn't true. I can defend myself. And then I went to the panel, and they're like, well, we're going to find you responsible. And I'm shocked. And I went to the Board of Trustees over the school, and I got it appealed for violation of due process. And then now I'm getting ready to go through this process again, and I'm terrified because I went to the Board of Governors, and I want everyone like, hey, how can you make sure they follow their standards? This hearsay shouldn't be preponderance of evidence, which university has to, you know, 51% is more likely than not to achieve a conviction, but they're not even holding to that, and that's the kind of situation I'm in, and that's what I'm saying is I don't think the standard is equal. And I don't apologize if my question is it being...
That's okay. Go ahead, Dr. Spano.
Well, we can't obviously, you know, comment on the specific case, and
I
think one of the things that is helpful to everyone is that the guidelines we've received recently from the federal government have not only helped protect the accuser, but also the person being accused. That these procedures are more transparent. There are clear rights of those who are being accused that are taken into consideration. There is a right for a hearing. There's a right for a timely adjudication of this, which can also be to the benefit of the person accused.
And, right for appeal?
And it does.
And a right for appeal.
And if the accused doesn't like the sentence, or if the accuser doesn't like the outcome of the trial, can they take it then to civil court outside of the university?
Well, certainly, to civil court or to criminal court.
Why would, given Todd's case, for instance, why would any university want to have to deal with this? Why wouldn't you just automatically refer this outside to the normal judicial process? Why would you want to deal with this?
Well, I think it was, as Kristen said earlier and as was mentioned, there are a couple of reasons. One is because we're required to by the federal government, and secondly, because it is harder to get the kind of justice in the courts that we might want to get on campus. And our standards are different, and our requirements around these issues are different by law.
Todd, thank you for your call, and that brings up a subject that Jack wants to talk about. Jack and Charlotte, welcome to the program.
Thanks. And this is really sort of a follow-on along the lines of the same question that Todd was just talking about. And I have two little girls, and they'll be coming along, so I'm by no means making light of anything. But I do not understand the thinking behind having a lower threshold to convict. And, you know, you have criminal courts that are staffed by juries, and not to be terribly stereotypical, but it's typically not the brightest, you know, most educated pool of people in the world that are on juries generally, versus colleges that are made up of people that are either in college or professors with doctorate degrees, and yet the standard to convict is so much lower on college campuses. I don't understand it, especially when you're talking about convictions that can wind up in expulsions, things that can ruin people's lives.
Yeah, so why is the standard of the...
Why is the standard lower?
Why is it lower?
Well, basically because we're not a criminal process. We're not putting people in jail for a period of time.
But if somebody is found to be guilty of sexual assault, that's on their record, isn't it? Doesn't it go on their permanent record? Don't they become a sexual offender?
No.
They do not.
They do not. Not if it's not a guilt that's found in a criminal court, no.
But they could be expelled from the school.
They could be expelled.
And what does that do to your ability to get into another school?
Well, in the UNC system, we do share that information across the system, and it does make it more difficult to get into another school in the system. But there's no national database for that. There's not a record that someone.
But I mean, if I want to go to a different system, if I want to go after I get expelled from your system, I want to go to the University of Oklahoma. What does my transcript say?
I don't believe it's part of the – and that's
– So you don't share an expulsion information with other universities?
I believe that's protected by the federal
Act. Do you share the reason for – you don't share that. So if you're convicted of this, that's not shared either.
Well, the word convicted is not accurate. It's found responsible for it. A conviction would be in the criminal court.
If you're found responsible, that's not shared either.
No.
If you're a repeat offender – because evidently some of these people that Kristen Lombardi reported on were repeat offenders. If you are a repeat offender, that information isn't shared either?
Unless it goes to the criminal court, I don't believe it is, no.
Okay. Jack, thank you for your call. Let me go to John in Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike.
Hello?
Go ahead.
I would note, following up on the last caller, and I would ask the lady who's on the phone, there's been a huge backlash that the burden in these cases should not be beyond a reasonable doubt, should not be by the preponderance of the evidence, but it should be clear and convincing evidence, a standard that has been widely used in these type of cases. And I would like for her to comment on the backlash that has been received by her office, the standard, when used in these procedures. And by the way, I've represented several young men in cases like this, and when you suddenly leave the college, the next college wants to know why. So this notion that it doesn't follow you just doesn't fly.
Okay. Do you understand the question?
I think he might have been asking the question of Kristen.
Oh, Kristen is no longer with us. If you're talking about the reporter from the Center for Public Integrity, she's not with us anymore. She had to leave.
Oh, well, then that is a very important point. Let me then, since she's not there, mm-hmm. there are three standards of proof that are used in proceedings: beyond a reasonable doubt, preponderance of the evidence, or clear and convincing evidence. And there has been a significant backlash to this notion that the correct standard in these cases should be by a preponderance of the evidence, given the fact that these sanctions that follow someone who is found responsible. And by the way, some of the North Carolina campuses still use the phrase not guilty or guilty after the Dear Colleague letter. So UNCC might not have, but that's not the way the system as a whole worked. And it is nice to hear some callers saying, yes, we have to protect victims of sexual assault, but we have to be very careful on college campuses because there are reports that turn out not to be
true.
Correct.
All right, John, thank you for your call. Do you find that to be the case? Or do more of these cases pan out to be not true or to be settled as not being you can't determine the truth of it?
Well, typically it's a very low percentage of what people call false reporting, but I hesitate to use that term. It's a very low percentage of people where the incident was not true. Is that what you're asking me?
Yeah. Yes. All right. We've heard a lot about binge drinking among young people on campus, off campus, et cetera. Is there a relationship, do you find, between alcohol use and all the – because for the average college student, alcohol – they're not old enough to drink alcohol, but we know that it happens. Is there a relationship between alcohol use and other drug use that leads to this more often than not?
Absolutely. I mean, most studies have shown that most sexual assaults occur when alcohol has been involved on campus. And so we're trying to take steps to lower the percentage of high-risk drinking on campus. And it certainly protects both the perpetrator, but more importantly, the potential victim who needs to be, very aware of what's happening around her or him and be safe.
We generally think of sexual assault as being perpetrated by the man on the woman. Are there incidences of sexual assault being perpetrated by women on men or men on men or women on women on college campuses?
Absolutely. And unfortunately, there's not as much data or statistical information out there in reference to maybe same-sex relationships versus opposite sex relationships. Mm-hmm. So,
what about in the reverse order, women on men?
Yes, that does happen. Mm-hmm. And usually, why we talk more about women being victims is because it's a very high percentage of women who are victims. And we know, too, first of all, it's an underreported crime. And then men, typically, it's even more underreported
right.
for men.
Okay.
And questions of occurrence are so hard to answer because it's so underreported. But the Justice Department study that Kristen mentioned noted that about 6% of men had reported that they were victims of sexual assault or attempted sexual assault.
Last week, President Obama signed an updated version of the Violence Against Women Act into law, which includes new requirements for how colleges and universities handle allegations of sexual assault. It's called the Campus Sexual Violence Elimination Act, and it clarifies the rights of victims of sexual assault, domestic violence, dating violence, and stalking on campus. In what way will this clear things up for you as administrators and as people who have to deal with this from a faculty point of view?
Well, it provides further guidance for us, which we find, you know, very useful, very helpful. It codifies the things that were in the Dear Colleague letter that we've mentioned during this hour. And I think will provide, a great blueprint for us moving forward as we try to make sure we're meeting federal guidelines.
What does it do for people who are who say they are victims of sexual assault? What does it do for them?
Well, I think it'll give them more options and opportunities for justice, for getting services, and for getting more comprehensive services. I think as well to mention, on top of providing more for victims, it's also going to provide more guidance for prevention initiatives as well. Because that's one of the things that we want to focus on, too, is prevention, which is very important.
I want to talk about that. But some people say that this new law pushes the pendulum too far in the opposite direction. The Foundation for Individual Rights says it gives too much protection to students who make accusations at the expense of the rights of the accused. Do you think a case can be made for that?
I think it's hard to make that case given the history of sexual assault on campus. But what we know and what the NPR report in 2010 illustrated was that we are, we're underreporting these events. The folks who are accused are typically not being not receiving sanctions that are particularly meaningful to them, and not protecting the potential victims. And so it's hard to make that case from my perspective.
We're talking about sexual assault on college campuses and how things may be changing in light of a new law signed into law by the president last week here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. You talked about prevention. What can students do to protect themselves? How does UNC Charlotte educate students about what their rights are, what they should look out for, how they prevent assaults, etc.?
Well, we're moving towards a focus more on primary prevention versus awareness. We want to have primary prevention and awareness, but what I mean by primary prevention is focusing on skills and tools that students can use to help other students. And a way that we can do that is through bystander intervention training. And that is a model where we're teaching students skills in order to intervene in situations that may just seem not quite right, or that may be an emergency situation, and how to intervene in those situations safely. So instead of it becoming, the personal responsibility of don't walk by yourself, all of those things, it's putting the responsibility on everybody. And we create a much more sense of community and looking out for each other as a campus community.
What kind of counseling do you make available for people who purport to be victims of sexual abuse on campus?
We have a comprehensive counseling center on campus. It's confidential and free for students, highly accessible, and anybody who encounters a student who claims or reports that she's or he has been sexually assaulted is referred to counseling.
What about those who are accused and maybe are wrongfully accused, or even accused and are guilty of that? What kind of resources are available to them?
They are also referred to counseling, and we do work with those students to help them deal with the aftermath of that. If they're found responsible, and there are some things in their behavior in the past that have been problematic, we try to address that with them, and we do get occasionally some of those referrals.
Between this new Dear Colleague letter that we've referenced several times in the program, and this new law that was just signed into effect, do you see this problem lessening in the future? Do you see it getting better for victims in the future as a result of all these things?
Our goal is the elimination of sexual assault on campus, and the campus the act that was just passed has that as its goal. And so, we're very hopeful, and a lot of the advocates are very hopeful.
Dr. David Spano is Associate Vice Chancellor for Health Programs and Services. Jennifer Cook is the Health Education Specialist with the Center for Wellness Promotion at UNC Charlotte. And Kristen Lombardi was with us earlier, an investigative reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. Thanks for the hour.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.